From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, starting a lesbian organization in the age of conformity, we talk with Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who co-founded the Daughters of Bilitis in 1955. It was the first national lesbian organization in America. Martin and Lyon have come to be known as mothers of the gay rights movement. And from our archives, an interview with actor Nicolas Cage. He starred in Wild at Heart, Moonstruck, Raising Arizona, Vampire's Kiss, and this year's hit comedy, Honeymoon in Vegas. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews Fletcher's Spain, the new book by British scholar Richard Fletcher, author of the award-winning The Quest for El Cid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Brazilian Vice President Itamar Franco was sworn in today as his country's new president, following the surprise resignation of former President Fernando Collor. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Collor's resignation was announced just minutes after the Brazilian Senate began trying him in absentia for allegedly receiving millions of dollars from a kickback scheme. By resigning, Collor avoided a virtually certain conviction by the Senate and the distinction of being the first president in history to be legally expelled from office. But Collor also sought to escape a punishment of being banned from holding public office for the next 8 years. The Senate must now decide whether to try and punish Collor despite his resignation. Meanwhile, Vice President Itamar Franco was sworn in as president 3 hours after Collor's resignation. Franco had been exercising the presidency ever since Collor was removed from power 3 months ago to stand trial following his impeachment by the lower house of Congress. I'm David Walna in Rio de Janeiro.
American and Russian arms negotiators in Geneva have reached agreement on a treaty that could reduce each nation's nuclear arsenal by as much as two-thirds. Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger told reporters that the two sides now have a text that can be presented to President Bush and Russian President Boris Yeltsin. If the two leaders approve, they could sign the agreement at a proposed summit meeting next week in the Russian Black Sea resort city of Sochi. Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev said there could be news from the two capitals within the next few days. Israel has published the names of 10 Palestinians it says it expelled by mistake. It's not clear how or when the men will be returned. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Of the 10 Palestinians Israel says it exiled by mistake, only one, a 16-year-old boy, was a case of mistaken identity. An army statement said the others had all been involved in anti-Israel activity, but should have been tried and jailed, not expelled. The statement also said that the men will be tried and could receive sentences longer than the two-year exiles. Israel today also offered to allow a Red Cross medical convoy to reach the men if Lebanon simultaneously allowed a convoy of food and fuel into the Palestinians' temporary tent camp. But Lebanon refused the proposal and told visiting United Nations envoy James Jonah that he is wasting his time. Lebanon also refused to allow Jonah access to the camp. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street, with the broader market responding to positive news on home sales and consumer confidence, while some blue-chip stocks experienced a late sell-off. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 22 points to close at 3,310.8. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. United Nations officials said today that humanitarian aid shipments have been resumed to the Kurds in northern Iraq. The shipments were suspended earlier this month after bombs damaged several Turkish trucks that were hauling the supplies across Iraq's northern border. Kurdish officials charged that the bombs were planted on the trucks by Iraqi agents at border checkpoints. The shipments were resumed after Iraq agreed to accept UN guards on board the trucks. New York Governor Mario Cuomo has decided to grant clemency to Jean Harris, the former school headmistress imprisoned for killing Scarsdale diet doctor Herman Tarnauer. The decision was announced just as Harris was preparing to undergo heart surgery. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
In a statement explaining his decision, Cuomo cited Harris's age and medical problems, as well as her record of assistance in prison rehabilitation programs. Cuomo's action does not automatically free Harris, but it does make it likely she will be paroled soon. The former headmistress of an exclusive Virginia boarding school, Harris was involved in one of the country's most sensational murder cases of recent years. She was convicted of the March 1980 shooting of Dr. Tarnauer, the author of a best-selling diet book. Harris allegedly was upset with Tarnauer because he was trying to end his relationship with her. She was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison and is now an inmate at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in Westchester County. Last week, Harris suffered a heart attack at the prison. She was reportedly told about Cuomo's decision just as she was to undergo quadruple bypass surgery. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
American Airlines announced a deal today to buy a one-third stake in Canadian Airlines International. American's investment in the struggling Canadian carrier will amount to $194 million. The two airlines will combine their frequent flyer programs and other services. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before there was a gay rights movement, there was the Daughters of Bilitis. It was the first national lesbian group in the country. My guests Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon co-founded it in 1955. They're now considered mothers of the gay rights movement. The Daughters of Bilitis was created as an alternative to the gay bar scene, but developed into an activist group with the mission of helping lesbians discover their potential and find their place in society. Martin is now 71, Lyon is 68. They've been a couple for 39 years. The group disbanded in the 70s, but Martin and Lyon have remained outspoken advocates of gay rights. 20 years ago, they collaborated on the book Lesbian Woman. A new anniversary edition was recently published. I asked them if they knew there was such a thing as a lesbian when they started having feelings toward women.
No.
No.
Sexuality was not talked about in those days, and let alone homosexuality.
Yeah, we're talking way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, I didn't really find out about lesbians until I met Del, actually.
And what year was that?
That was in
1949,
right. And I knew vaguely that there were such things as male homosexuals, but that was about it. But when I look back, I know that I was always fascinated with women. I just didn't have a clue as to what to do about that.
Del, what about you? What was the first time that you had a sense that you felt things toward other women?
Oh, when I was about 10 or 12, and I, figured that I was different and I was the only one.
The only one in the world?
The only one in the world. That's a story we hear over and over again in our age group. Everybody thought, oh, I'm the only one.
Well, you got married when you were 19. Did you?
Right.
Did you do that in spite of thinking that you were different?
At that particular time, there was no woman that I was particularly attracted to, so I thought maybe that was over with.
Where did you each find out more about other lesbians, about the fact that you weren't alone? Did you turn to books? Did you turn to other people?
Well, there really weren't any books except, you know, unless you went to the library. First, you had to know the word homosexual or lesbian in order to look anything up.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was nothing that was any good in the libraries in those early days.
And mostly it just told you how sick you were.
So it frightened you when you found the books, actually.
Right. There's no way that we could identify with that. I think the first book that I read that helped me out was Radcliffe Hall's book.
The Well of Loneliness, yeah.
You both read that?
No, I didn't. Somehow or other I missed that. So that I was still, I was through college and working before I found out about lesbians. And that was only because it was about 1949 that Del and I and another woman we worked with were having drinks at the press club in Seattle after work, and somehow or other the subject came up, and Del said she was a lesbian, and I was fascinated because I'd never met one before, I thought. And the first thing I did when I got home was call everybody I knew and tell them.
Tell them about Dell?
Yeah. I didn't know that that was a bad thing. Fortunately, it had no repercussions to speak of.
Yeah, talk about outing.
Talk about naivete.
So, Phyllis, did you get the feeling right away that, well, you know, maybe you were too? Did that strike you?
Not right at the moment. We had already become pretty close friends, Del and I. And then, of course, I was curious. But one of the things I had discerned about myself was that in my relationships with men, what I was doing was, in essence, sort of chasing after the ones I was interested in. And then when I caught them, as it were, then I became disinterested. And I was kind of afraid that the same thing would happen if I chased after Dell. So I didn't do anything for quite a while, as a matter of fact.
Then she was going to leave town and...
For good.
And so it was then or never.
Who made the first move?
I did, but as Phyllis says, I made a pass and she completed it.
She sort of made a half pass.
How did you both meet?
On the job. We were working for trade publications in Seattle.
And so you knew each other from working together?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, I was working in Seattle before, and then the boss told us all that he had this gay divorcee coming from San Francisco.
He didn't know how gay.
And so, I was fascinated because I had lived in San... I went to UC Berkeley, and I had lived partially in San Francisco, and it was great to know somebody from down there was coming up.
Del, you had already been married. What happened to end the marriage?
I fell in love with a woman next door, and that, you know, my feelings were really awakened by then, and I just felt I needed to do something about it.
When you started being a couple, a lot of lesbian relationships were in the kind of butch femme mode. Was your relationship that way too early on?
Well, it was sort of, yeah. I think that it didn't really stay that way very long, although to all intents and purposes, we were still a butch femme couple in public. Since Dell had decided, when I met her, had decided she was a butch, I didn't have much of an option. So I became a femme. I've often thought I would have made a really good butch. And besides which, I did all of the butch kind of things, if you will. I mean, I drive and Dell doesn't, and I can drive a nail in and she can't, and, you know, stuff like that. But we conformed to what the going thing was outside the home, but not certainly didn't do it when we were at home.
Yeah, I was a sissy butch.
Yeah.
So there was pressure on you. You felt that, like, I mean, from what you knew about lesbian couples, this is the way it had to be. This is the way it was supposed to be, butch and femme.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, that's how everybody was doing. Because at that point in time, the only model anybody had was mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody was kind of following that.
Yeah, and when we first got together, I had a job that I had lined up before I came down back to San Francisco from Seattle, and Phyllis would get up and make me breakfast, which I didn't like to eat in those days. That didn't last very long.
That's what my mother had always done, right? She had always gotten up and gotten Dad's breakfast. So I thought, well, this is what you have to do. But as Dell said, it didn't last very long.
When did you give it up?
I didn't like doing it either.
When did you give it up?
Oh, probably within a month.
Oh, that quickly?
Oh, I think so.
Oh, yeah, at least. Yeah,
might have been sooner.
Well, how did you bring it up with each other that you're going to change and that you weren't going to conform to that standard anymore?
I don't think we really talked about it. We just sort of acted like ourselves.
Phyllis, how do you think the relationship was changed when you decided to give up those roles?
Well, I think what happened was that we just became the people that we had when we became friends. We didn't really deal with those kinds of roles because I was supposedly Dale's straight friend anyway. So we were on a different kind of footing. Then when we became lovers, there was this sudden switch from, you know, masculine, feminine. She was supposed to be the aggressor and all these kinds of things. And I think then we just wandered back to being the people that we actually were, which was neither the aggressor nor the non-aggressor, if you will.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Dale Martin and Phyllis Lyon. Their 1972 book, Lesbian Woman, has just been published in a new edition. And they're the founders of the group Daughters of Bilitis, which is the first national lesbian organization. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dale Martin and Phyllis Lyon are my guest. You met in 1949. In 1955, you co-founded Daughters of Bilitis. Why did you feel you wanted to start some kind of organization? And what did you have in mind when you started it? What did you want it to be? What did you need it to be?
Well, it wasn't our idea, but we had met a lesbian through a couple of gay men that lived around the corner from us. And she called us one morning, Saturday morning, and said, how would you like to join with us in a social club for lesbians? And we were just delighted because we didn't know any, and we were so starved for socializing with other lesbians that we jumped at the chance. What Daughters of Bilitis started out to be was a very secret lesbian social club.
Where did the name come from, Daughters of Bilitis?
From the Songs of Bilitis by Pierre Louis, which is a long lesbian narrative poem.
It's a poem you knew?
The lesbian who invited us to join the club had read the book, and she offered that as a suggestion for the name of it.
She thought that lesbians would know what Bilitis meant, but nobody else would. I don't think that was true, because I don't think most lesbians knew about the Songs of Bilitis. However, it worked out as a name.
It was supposed to be a secret, and we have spent many, many years now trying to explain the name.
So I guess it worked pretty well. You know, some people, when they hear the name, think it sounds like a disease, Bilitis.
Well, that's why we pronounced it Bilitis.
Instead of Bilitis, like phlebitis?
Instead of Bilitis, because we didn't want it to sound like a disease. And that was at the time, you know, when Eisenhower had ileitis, and so we said, no, it's got to be Bilitis, so it doesn't sound like an illness.
So you were trying to keep the organization, you know, very, very secret to protect the members. Were there ways that lesbians could let other lesbians know who they were, like little cues lesbians could give each other through the way they dressed or wore their hair or whatever?
Well, I think that's probably why so many lesbians dress pretty butchy, to let others know that here's a possibility.
Did you go to the bars at all before or after you co-founded Daughters of Bilitis?
Oh, yeah.
What was the bar scene like then?
Well, what was it like? It was, for many lesbians, it was the only outlet. It was the only place they had to go where they could be themselves. It was the only place they knew to go to meet other lesbians, for sure, you know, without being, you know, perhaps making a costly mistake. And it's true there was a lot of drinking, which is what goes on in bars. but it was the only place. It was the only...
And it was a risky place.
Yeah.
Because periodically there would be police raids. And one of the things that we worked through on that one was during the Daughters of Belitis, when we started to have public
discussion meetings,
and we got attorneys to come and talk to us and tell us our rights. And what we found when a bar raid took place, that most everybody pleaded guilty and to a plea of disturbing the peace or visiting a house of ill repute or whatever to get out of it and pay a fine. But in actuality, what they were pleading guilty to was being gay, because they hadn't done anything that was illegal in these places. They were just there. So when we found an attorney who said, just plead nulla contendere, so you were there. And then when police officer was asked, you know, what we did or in the bars, all I could say just rounded us all up, and there was nothing that the court could do but let us go. When I say us, I'm talking about lesbians in general. Phyllis and I never got caught up in a raid. We missed one by a day, another by a week, but we didn't get caught up. But we did find legal help for those who did.
When you started Daughters of Belitis, there was a gay men's counterpart at the time, the Mattachine Society. How did the two groups get along?
Well, the Mattachine Society was primarily gay males, and it was open to women, you know, to lesbians, but they had very few, and it was so male-oriented. However, they were helpful to us. At one point, they let us share an office, a very tiny one, until we could get ourselves in gear and find our own quarters.
What were the issues that you felt the two groups had in common, and the issues in which you diverted from each other?
Well, I think basically what we had in common was the fact that we were both homosexual, and therefore we were illegal, immoral, and sick. Other than that, the lesbians' concerns were more on civil concerns, not so much criminal concerns, whereas gay men were always getting into difficulties around public restrooms and cruising in public places and so on. Lesbians were more concerned about bringing up their children, if they had children, about how to keep their household together, how to buy a house together if that was possible, and things like that. It was typical differences between men and women, really.
Mm-hmm.
And Mattachine was going before Daughters of Belitis, but we didn't know about it until after DOB got started. But the men were very chauvinistic for the most part.
How so?
They were men.
Yeah. Right.
Anybody who thinks that gay men are not masculine in the sense of being very righteous and it's their baby, forget it. As far as the lesbians were concerned, they could join, they could be receptionists or typists, but never really a part of it.
But this was before feminism, so I mean, not only
right.
Right.
Not only was gay rights in its very formative stages, there really wasn't a strong women's rights movement at the time either. So you didn't have a word feminism to describe your feelings of the men being chauvinistic. So did you have a context to put that in?
Well, no, we didn't know that much about feminism, but we did write articles about discrimination against women in the early days.
Mm-hmm. Certainly lesbians were aware that they needed to work because nobody was going to come along and support them. And and we were also aware that we didn't get paid the same money that men did. We didn't quite know what we could do about that.
But as a matter of fact, in the jobs where we met, we received titles rather than raises.
Yeah.
Let me jump ahead a little bit. You were active in the formation of the gay rights movement in the late 60s and early 70s when the gay rights movement really expanded. Were there things that you felt really involved with and then issues that you felt kind of left out of for generational reasons? You know what I mean? Because you'd come of age during a more repressive era.
Mm. Well, but we had never left, Terry. I mean, we had never quit being involved with the movement, and we had also become involved with the women's movement. And mm-hmm. As soon as NOW got started, we got involved with NOW and so on. So I don't know that we ever felt as if we were left out. I think that when Lesbian Woman came out in 1972, we thought that maybe we would have problems when we went around to university campuses and so on to talk about it, that they might think we were a couple of old fuddy-duddies and, you know, and trash us, as it were. But that didn't happen because we found that no matter how radical people were becoming and so on, they still had these basic questions and basic problems like, how do you tell your parents that you're gay? And what do you do about coming out in school and so on?
What are the issues that you're active in now?
Well, we're now with the Gay and Lesbian Outreach to Elders. I'm 71.
And I was just 68 a while ago. And, so we're very interested in the militant movement of old lesbians, which is very militant and very active. That's lesbians 60 and up. And we're still involved with feminist issues, and we've been very much involved in politics, and we're just elated at what has happened in this election, that we have elected so many pro-choice and pro-gay rights people, like our two women from California, Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator-elect Barbara Boxer.
Well, and the thing, we're getting pretty much involved with the whole issue of ageism through the old lesbians. And as we have said, we've had to invent our lives as we've gone along, and now we're inventing our lives as old lesbians.
As aging lesbians now, you said you're working on ageism as an issue. What are some of the things that you're facing now socially in America that are new for you as you age?
Well, I think it's sort of the same things that are happening to all old people, that one becomes invisible if one has gray hair very often. People tend to talk to the younger people that are with you instead of to you as if you were some kind of an idiot person. It's just...
Well, the assumption that we're all old and decrepit.
Right.
And, those who really took care of their bodies and exercised are still in very good shape.
Did you?
No. But we're in good shape anyway. Exercise has not been something we have indulged in over the years.
Well, I wish you good health and good luck, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Dil Martin and Phyllis Lyon co-founded the Daughters of Bilitis. There's a new 20th anniversary edition of their book, Lesbian Woman, published by Volcano Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up from the archives, an interview with actor Nicolas Cage, not meant for the squeamish. We talk with Cage about his roles in Wild at Heart, Moonstruck, and Vampire's Kiss. He starred in this year's hit comedy, Honeymoon in Vegas. And John Leonard reviews a new book on Moorish Spain by British scholar Richard Fletcher. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Quest for El Cid. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Officials of the United States and Russia have reached tentative agreement on an historic arms reduction treaty, START II, that would cut each nation's nuclear arsenals by about two-thirds. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Details of the agreement were negotiated in Geneva by Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev and Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger, who said the proposed treaty must now be approved by President Yeltsin and President Bush. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said approval is likely. We assume we have an agreement, and we will be able to sign it with President Yeltsin in Russia this weekend, he said. Mr. Bush would stop in Russia on his way back from a New Year's visit with American troops in Somalia. In addition to reducing overall strategic arsenals, the START II agreement would eliminate hundreds of the most destabilizing, most threatening nuclear weapons, land-based long-range missiles with multiple warheads. President-elect Bill Clinton praised the tentative agreement today. "I think the quicker we can get these kind of positive results, the better," he said. "I was fully supportive of making an agreement before I took office." This is Ted Clark in Washington.
According to top U.S. officials, more Iraqi planes violated a no-fly zone over southern Iraq yesterday, one day after one Iraqi airplane was shot down. Officials say that those intercepted yesterday turned back, and no weapons were fired. While Baghdad has said it will strike back for the downed airplane, Iraq's ambassador to the U.N. says his government wants to avoid a military confrontation. The aircraft carrier USS Kitty Hawk is now on its way to the Persian Gulf, after being stationed off the coast of Somalia. A no-fly zone was imposed by Western allies as a means of protection for Muslim rebels. An airliner scheduled for a domestic trip inside Cuba landed in Miami today. The plane's pilot and most of its passengers are now seeking political asylum. Doug Phillips reports.
The twin-engine Soviet-made plane landed in Miami after airport officials received a radio message from Cuba that the plane had been, quote, kidnapped. According to Dade County aviation spokesman Chris Mangos, not all 53 people who were on the plane want to remain in the United States.
What we were able to determine was that the pilot had requested political asylum here. However, we understand that the co-pilot and four other people have indicated that they wish to return.
The five who want to return to Cuba will be handed over to the State Department. The others are being interviewed by immigration officials. The plane's pilot walked off the aircraft, giving a thumbs-up signal and saying the word Libre, Spanish for freedom. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 22 points to close at 3,310.84 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Conference Board says its index of consumer confidence climbed in the month of December to its highest point in nearly 2 years. The study by the private research group says its consumer confidence study rose to 78.3 this month from 65.6 in November. At the same time, the Business Board said that people are still saying that jobs are hard to find, but there has been an increase in those people who expect jobs to become more plentiful in the next 6 months. In Belgrade, Yugoslavia's federal prime minister has been ousted from power by a no-confidence vote in parliament. NPR's Silvia Pajoli reports from Belgrade.
Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic's ruling Socialist Party and its allied ultra-nationalist Radical Party dealt Panic a humiliating defeat today, only 9 days after he lost his election bid to replace Milosevic. It was an overwhelming vote of no confidence, 95-2 in the lower house and 30-5 in the upper chamber. The parliament then approved Deputy Prime Minister Radoje Kontič as interim government leader, sparking a potential constitutional crisis since the nomination should be made by Yugoslavia's federal president, Dobrica Čosić. The latest developments added to the tension created by Milosevic's re-election in a vote international observers said was flawed with widespread irregularities. Milosevic has been singled out by the international community as the person most responsible for the war in Bosnia, and there have been increased calls in the West for military intervention to end the bloodshed. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
In Toronto, officials of Canadian Airlines say that American Airlines plans to buy a stake in the Canadian air carrier for some $195 million. A spokesman for American Airlines says this new agreement has substantial benefits for both companies. The agreement apparently calls for merger of some operations. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During this holiday week, along with our new interviews, we're featuring some interviews from our archives. We're going to hear an interview with Nicolas Cage, recorded in July of 1990. This year, Cage starred in the hit comedy Honeymoon in Vegas. Earlier in his career, he starred opposite Cher in Moonstruck and Kathleen Turner in Peggy Sue Got Married. He was an ex-con who kidnaps a baby to keep his marriage alive in Raising Arizona. In Vampire's Kiss, he was convinced he was turning into Nosferatu. Though Nicolas Cage often plays ex-cons and working-class characters, his own background is quite different. His father has been the Dean of Creative Arts at San Francisco State University, and his uncle is film director Francis Ford Coppola. I spoke with Cage just before the opening of Wild at Heart. Cage starred as an ex-con on the road. I wanted to know how Cage liked working with the film's director, David Lynch. Lynch later directed the TV series Twin Peaks. His work has a dreamlike quality which gives actors the opportunity to go beyond realism.
I think the dream state is a wonderful playground, and it gives an actor license to do just about anything, which is a hell of a lot of fun for me, because I was starting to feel kind of stagnated and kind of just locked into this whole naturalism thing. And I started looking for scripts such as Vampire's Kiss, which a lot of it happens in the hallucinatory state or the psychotic dream state, and Peggy Sue Got Married, which also was sort of a dream state, if you will, from Kathleen Turner's point of view. And then David, who has this very specific world that he creates, is almost always in that kind of higher reality, if you will, kind of dream state. So it's a very liberating thing to be able to work in that kind of a format. The problem with it, though, is that there are very few movies which allow for that kind of behavior, to basically let go and try new things. So you know, you have to sort of go back to your roots, or naturalism, if you will.
Is it a true story that when you were doing the film Birdie, and this was in the early part of the 1980s, that you pulled two teeth as part of your getting into the role?
Well, actually, what happened was I had baby teeth up until I was 22, and I couldn't get, they wouldn't come out, so by coincidence, simultaneously, I had to pull the teeth out while I was making Birdie so that the other teeth would come in, because they were getting impacted. And I guess people just thought it was some example of wacko method, you know, masochism, which it really wasn't.
Nevertheless, did it help you in the role to experience so much pain? Because
well,
I think
yeah,
that's what
actually,
people assumed it was for. Yeah.
I figured as long as it's here, might as well use it, you know.
So how did you use it? What does that mean?
Well, if you're experiencing dental pain while you're doing a scene where your face has been blown off, just basically you don't have to act. Just use the dental pain.
Can you tell when you watch the movie back that you were experiencing real pain?
Yeah. Yeah, I can. I don't actually like to watch that movie, to tell you the truth.
Because you don't like the movie?
No, I like the movie. It's just that It was like, it was a little private, you know. I let so much stuff come out, and I get a little embarrassed when I see it, just because it's just so bare.
Have you ever gone to real extremes, the equivalent of pulling teeth, to get into a role?
Yeah, I mean, the whole, I had to learn while I was working and learn publicly through trial and error, and sometimes I fell on my face and sometimes it worked, but I started at a pretty early age. I started when I was 17, and I really didn't have that much training. So I basically just did all the things that I'd heard the other great actors had done, like staying up all night to do a scene the next day to look tired, or really doing the method thing. And on Cotton Club, I was playing a pretty crazy gangster who was very feared in Harlem. And I would walk down the street in New York and, you know, smash people's remote control cars and have everything scatter and, you know, really believe I was this psychotic killer. And by the time I was about to do the scene the next day, I brought all that stuff to the scene and it worked. But, you know, needless to say, I wasn't liked very much. And I mean, I do have a life and I don't really want to live the part anymore. So I stopped doing that, and I realized I could get there without all that intense living the role kind of thing.
So what did you do? You smashed remote control cars?
Well, I went down Christopher Street, and there was a guy selling remote control cars for $50, and I said, let me see that, and I put it in the middle of the street, and I jumped on and smashed it, and all the pieces were flying around, all the people just scattered and saying, oh, you're crazy, and all this, and I did give the guy $50 for it, but it just sort of helped me believe that I could create fear in people, which is what that character did in the movie.
So you had no confidence that you were really capable of generating fear in somebody before that?
Well, it felt like I was able to, you know. I'm really not a violent guy. I'm not a fighter. I'm not into that. But when I was playing that role, at least at that point, I was young and I was just experimenting with trying to evoke that so that I could believe it in myself or the character. I've learned that it's just not necessary, and it's actually a lot more creative and thoughtful to just, you know, act the role a little bit sometimes.
Have you ever tried something pretty outrageous in a role and had a director object to it and say that's too far out?
Yeah. I was doing Racing with the Moon, and I've always had this idea of breaking the fourth wall, which is like taking it into hyperrealism, which is what I did in Vampire's Kiss, actually, when I ate the cockroach. I wanted people to know that it was really happening and to get into that and create that sort of visceral aura. And, in Racing with the Moon, I took a pocket knife out and I basically cut my arm open and wanted the blood to go and flow on film and have people know it was a very realistic moment. And Richard Benjamin basically said, wrong movie, Nick, let's cool out a little.
So did he want you to use fake blood, or did he not like that whole idea of self-mutilation anyways?
He just didn't like the idea at all. It wasn't even in the script.
I just wanted to do this one thing,
you know, and try to do something hyper-real. I was experimenting with a lot of different things back then, and I'm glad I did it and went through it, but I do feel like now it's a little bit easier for me to arrive at what is needed in the scene emotionally or in terms of character without doing that intense, self-destructive kind of acting.
My guest is actor Nicolas Cage. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview from our archives with actor Nicolas Cage. Let's talk a little bit about Vampire's Kiss. This is the movie that you referred to before, that you ate the cockroach in. This is a wonderful film. You play a character who is a very obnoxious literary agent, and he thinks he's turning into a vampire because he's He's gone to bed with someone who he believes bit him, you know, a vampire, a female vampire who he believes bit him. And he starts, you know, shrinking at the sign of the cross and asking people to put a stake through his heart to take him out of his misery. It's an incredibly original performance that you give. It just seemed to me like you must have watched all the new and old horror films to get the classic vampire gestures for the movie.
Well, you know, that's true, actually. I was exposed to the movie Nosferatu at a very early age because my father was, teaching film. And the original Nosferatu, starring Max Schreck, the black and white silent vampire movie, gave me nightmares for years. And those images, especially his body language and his gestures and movements, stayed with me, and I always thought it'd be great to be able to incorporate that kind of silent film acting where they were using their bodies more because they had to compensate for the lack of sound and try to bring it into modern film. And with Vampire's Kiss, I saw an opportunity to do that, kind of explore that German expressionist style of acting that those guys were doing back then, like in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and even Emil Jannings. And the only way I could pull it off, I figured, was if the character was insane, because you can't really act like that in modern film in a normal format, because people just wouldn't understand or get it or relate to it or want to relate to it. But if the character is insane, and especially if he thinks he's turning into a vampire, there's just a wonderful landscape of things you can do. And so I brought those old style gestures to the character because of his insanity, basically.
Well, let's get to the cockroach eating sequence.
There's
a scene where you're in your kitchen, and this is after you've decided you're turning into a vampire, and there's a cockroach crawling across the burner of the stove. And you scoop it up in your hand and eat it. Now, we don't see you swallow it in the movie, but we do see you chewing on it. And there's no edit, so it's definitely the real thing that's gone in your mouth,
I
think.
Definitely the real thing. Originally, they wanted me to eat raw eggs, and that didn't do anything for me.
Sylvester Stallone had already done that.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted to tie in the Renfield thing, you know, Renfield from the Dracula novel where he was eating the bugs and stuff. And
Renfield's always the assistant who's in the insane asylum eating insects.
Right, he's the assistant to Dracula. And it was a slow progression for Peter Lowe. I mean, first he's eating pistachios, then he's eating a cockroach. Then he finally eats the dove and ultimately bites a girl's neck and kills her and drinks her blood. So it was like this progressive building from pistachio to girl. And the cockroach was one of the steps in the disintegration of Peter Lowe. So I said, you know, I want to try eating a cockroach. And everybody was like, you've got to be crazy. And I said, yeah, I know what you mean. I really don't like cockroaches myself. And they wrangled up three New York cockroaches out of somebody's basement. And the day arrived where I had to do it, and I saw the bug when I walked on the set, and the legs were kicking and the antennas were going, and it looked huge. And I almost said, guys, I can't do it. And I figured that would be a cop-out because, you know, I'd set it up and made them wrangle for cockroaches for weeks. And, I put the cockroach close to me, and every muscle in my body was just saying, don't do it. And the wings were going, and then I did it, and I couldn't sleep for about 3 days, and I couldn't eat, but, well, I did it, and there it is. You know what I mean?
Did you call a doctor first and ask if chewing a cockroach could kill you?
No. Yeah, they said it would be okay. What I did was I rinsed my mouth out with 100-proof vodka and sterilized my mouth before I did it. And then when I spat the cockroach out, I sterilized it again.
What did it taste like?
Oh, you know, I couldn't remember. All I know is it was soft. It was not crunchy. It was soft, and it was just a nightmare.
Does it ever come back and haunt you?
Well, when I talk about it like this and I start thinking about it, I get goosebumps. I mean, I'm starting to get the willies again.
Huh. No, but don't you collect exotic insects and animals?
Well, I like exotic fish. I like anything to do with the ocean, and I'm not really a bug fan. I mean, I have a 4-foot perfect, highly detailed model of a wasp in my living room that I stare at on occasion, but I don't really have a huge bug collection, no.
Okay. Nicolas Cage is my guest. You have, I've read, a tattoo of a lizard on your back.
Right.
I mean, when you see your back looking in a two-way mirror or something, doesn't it give you the creeps?
No, I that's part of the reason why I put it on my back. I really don't see it that often.
Well, why did you put it there?
Well, it was Halloween 1984, and I broke up with my girlfriend. I was just feeling like I had to do something radical. And when I look back on it, I was 20 years old at the time, and I guess I was getting ready to become a man, and it was like my way of saying, I'm my own person, and I'm breaking free of the family, and I was the first one in the family to get a tattoo. So I guess in retrospect, it was kind of a walkabout, if you will, or a bar mitzvah.
How did you show it to your family?
Well, I remember I just said, Dad, I got a tattoo, and I lifted up my shirt, and he saw it, and his face went white, and he had himself a martini, and that was that.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Nicolas Cage, recorded in July of 1990. We'll hear interviews from the archives with Martin Short and John Cleese later this week. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the START agreement with the Russians?
Well, apparently there is an agreement, Terry, but we're going to be discussing what we think is the difficulty down the road of implementing it now that there is more than one nuclear republic and apparently not everybody agrees on every detail. We also have a couple of reports from the former Yugoslavia, one from Silvia Poggioli on Milan Panic being thrown out of the legislature, and a report from Bosnia where fighting is apparently about to get very serious indeed. Gene Harris has been granted clemency, and an airliner has been hijacked from Cuba to Miami. Lots of news today.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. They say that ignorance is bliss. Well, book critic John Leonard may not have been blissful or ignorant, but he was at least happy with his image of Moorish Spain until Richard Fletcher's new book came along. Fletcher is an award-winning British scholar whose book The Quest for El Cid won England's Wolfson Literary Award for History in 1989. John has a review of the new book, Fletcher's Spain.
My excuse for romanticizing Moorish Spain is better than most. A handsome 2-volume edition of Washington Irving's The Conquest of Granada is my only patrimony. They may have been the only 2 books my father ever owned, and there's no evidence that my father, who sang tenor, drank rye, and died young, ever read them. But I did, along with Irving's Tales from the Alhambra, and I've dreamed ever since of Arab mathematicians in long flowing robes, floating like ghosts among striped columns and blue mosaics, of dark poets in the Caliph's garden. Richard Fletcher, the English historian of medieval Iberia, will have none of this dreaminess. Back in 1989, in the search for El Cid, He explained that the hero of the epic poem was really a mercenary thug, a sword for hire, equally by Christians and Muslims. But Fletcher also hinted that the Moors, too, had their warts. Now he tells the whole story, and this demystification hurts me and my father. However much I would prefer to believe that the Islamic presence in southern Spain, from 711 till 1492, was more civilized than Spain perhaps deserved, the evidence is otherwise. Cordoba's glory, and Granada's, and Seville's, depended on ransom, tribute, gold, and slavery. Because the elite Arabs were unkind to their own second-class Berbers, the Berbers were always revolting. These warrior aristocracies pillaged each other's city-states, just like the Christian princelings of Aragon and Castile. And just like those princelings, they periodically slaughtered Jews. As much as Moorish Spain was a victim of invasions by Fernando, Isabella, and El Cid, it was also the victim of invasions from North Africa by Moroccan fundamentalists who felt that the Andalusians, in their honeycomb domes, around their pools of lions and myrtles, had gone soft in the faith of the Prophet. And according to Fletcher, people like me are soft on the Moors because we're nostalgic for some mythical Garden of Eden, what he calls the August pomegranate of Andalusia. To this nostalgia, we've also added a dash of Anglo-Saxon Protestant prejudice against Spanish Catholicism, plus some 19th-century romantic fluff and some 20th-century liberal guilt about the evils of colonialism. But the Moors themselves were conquistadors and colonizers. It ought to be enough for us, it's certainly enough for this scrupulous historian, that they gave back to the West the secrets of Greek antiquity and Neoplatonism, of Aristotle and Hypatia, that with their own advanced philosophy, geometry, astronomy, optics, and medicine, they made it possible for Aquinas to prove the existence of God, for Newton to fall into gravity, and for Dante to go to hell. That without them, there would have been no watermelon, spinach, or artichoke, no limes or figs in our garden. And Fletcher has a wonderful time quoting their poetry, which sings like birds in their palace aviaries. Moorish Spain is lots to think about. On reflection, it seems to me that almost every ancient civilization I have admired as a tourist, standing in its bare ruined choirs, was likewise based on gold and slaves, or went in for foot binding and female infanticide, or for cannibalism and clitorectomies. I'm glad, in a way, that my father didn't know this, and sort of sorry that I do.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Fletcher's Spain by Richard Fletcher. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Steve Motter. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look back at the year's best in film and pop music with critics Stephen Schiff and Ken Tucker. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.